Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Ann Packer, who reads from and discusses her new book, Songs Without Words, published by Knopf. In the weeks to come, we have Carl Bernstein, Richard Russo, Mary Carwile, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Covered, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. We are so very glad to welcome Ann Packer back to the Tattered Cover. She was last here to present her astonishing and highly acclaimed bestseller, The Dive from Clausen's Pier, a book that author Scott Turow hailed as, quote, one of those small miracles that reinforce our faith in fiction. It does what the best novels so often do, making the largest things visible by its perfect rendering of life on the smaller scale, unquote. It spent nearly a dozen weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Well, with her talent and her pen, Ann Packer has done it again with her new novel, Songs Without Words, a work that explores a lifelong friendship and the wounds and cracks that surface with the arrival of a harrowing crisis, a teenager's attempted suicide. Ann attended Yale University and the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and her first book was a collection of short stories entitled Mendocino and Other Stories. Additionally, her short stories have appeared in The New Yorker and Plowshares. She is the recipient of a James Michener Award and a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship. The Dive from Clausen's Pier also received the Kate Chopin Literary Award, and you'll be glad to know that she is currently at work on a collection of stories and a novella. But in the meantime, we are so glad to welcome her here for her second novel. Please welcome Ann Packer.
Thank you so much. What a nice introduction. I'm really happy to be back here in Denver and back at the new, can we say that, Tattered Cover? What a great space. It's really fantastic. I'm just going to play around with this a little. Everyone still hear me? Okay. So Songs Without Words is a novel about two women, Liz and Sarah Beth, who have been friends since they were childhood neighbors in Palo Alto, California. Palo Alto is a suburb south of San Francisco. And they had one of those little girl best friendship things going on. And then the friendship deepened when they were 16 and Sarah Beth's mother committed suicide. And aside from a prologue that takes place during that high school time, the novel is actually set 30 years later. And they have remained incredibly close, although gone in very different directions. Liz has stayed near Palo Alto. She's married a businessman, a guy who works in Silicon Valley named Brody. And they have two teenagers, Lauren, who's 15, and Joe, who's 13. And she is a very contented stay-at-home mom. Sarah Beth, on the other hand, is across the bay in Berkeley and living a somewhat unsettled life, both in terms of her work and in terms of personal relationships. She's had a series of somewhat ill-fated love affairs, and most recently with a married man named Billy, but that is over now. And for work, she sort of does a patchwork of things. She stages houses that are being put on the market so that they will appeal to buyers. She makes lampshades from handmade paper, and she reads aloud to the blind. And what she's reading right now is Anna Karenina. And what I'm going to do is read one section about Sarah Beth and one section about Liz, to give you a sense of both of the women. And then that'll take 25 minutes maybe, and then I'd love to take questions. I think that's it. I will start. And Sarah Beth comes first. Next on Sarah Beth's schedule was Emeryville, Mark Murphy's shop. She turned on the radio, and there was a woman's voice singing, "Look at me, I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree. She turned the radio back off, but the silent song had taken hold, and in her mind she heard, I grow misty just holding your hand. She imagined a little girl walking hand in hand with a woman, and it was the day that was misty. They were both wearing dark, knee-length coats, as in the 60s. It was like a scene from a movie, piano music on the soundtrack. You saw them from the back, and you knew they were walking toward something scary or dangerous or sad. Switch to the girl's point of view as she looks up. The woman's face is pale. The girl looks for another moment, then focuses on her feet, the step, step, step of her black Mary Janes. Sarah Beth gunned the engine as she merged onto the freeway. It was late morning on a Tuesday, not much traffic. How she lived made sense in a certain way. The bits and pieces of work she did that added up to a living, a life. Sometimes, though, like now, the energy it took to haul herself from place to place seemed out of reach. Mark Murphy's shop was in a refurbished warehouse in the industrial part of Emeryville. He shared the lease with an artisanal bakery, and as Sarah Beth entered the high-ceiling space, she breathed in the aroma of baking bread. "What do you have for me?" he said. He had a way of giving almost everything he said a slight sexual gloss, and Sarah Beth blushed lightly. He was attractively tall and narrow-hipped, and he wore his Levi's tight. "It's a new one," she said. "I was thinking about the mocha, and I thought, let's try something for people who aren't afraid of color." He tilted his head to the side and smiled his dry, slightly mocking smile. At first, this smile had put Sarah Beth off. It had taken months for her to realize it didn't necessarily reflect what he was thinking or what he was going to say, although it could. "Color," he said. "I'm intrigued." Opening the flaps, sliding away the tissue paper, he was standing behind her now. She took hold of the piece by the wire spokes and pulled it clear of the box. "Ooh," he said, "that's nice." He pushed papers out of the way so she could set it on his desk. "That is nice." "Thank you," she said primly, but in fact she was quite pleased. She'd found some handmade dusty rose paper and fashioned a lampshade unlike any she'd made before. She'd glued braid around the narrow top and the prettily flared bottom, and the shape was almost saucy. "It's very McCabe and Mrs. Miller," he said. "Kind of welcome to our bordello." She cracked a smile. "How much paper did you buy?" he asked. "Only enough for the prototype." This wasn't quite true. She'd bought all that was left on the roll, 3 yards and change. But Mark was your classic hard-to-get guy, and she played fire against fire. And wondered about his 20-year marriage. Did he have affairs? Or was it perhaps enough to flirt, to be forever sought? His wife, Mary, was a friend of Sarah Beth's friend, Nina. That was the route Sarah Beth had taken to him in the first place. And at the beginning, on meeting him, she had thought, why didn't Nina tell me they were splitting up? Now she thought, why didn't Nina tell me they were so solid? What if I wanted to place an order, he said. A dozen of welcome to our bordello. She suppressed a smile. I could check back with my supplier. Why don't you do that, Sarah Beth? He leaned against his desk and crossed one long leg in front of the other. He had big hands, big knuckles, and his wedding ring nestled in the fine hairs on his ring finger. It had swirls carved into the gold. It said, we got married back when Zen gardens first got popular. Okay, she said, I'll leave you a voicemail. She started to put the lampshade back in the box, but he reached out a hand to her forearm, and she stopped. Do you have a sec, he said. Sure. He pushed away from the desk and headed toward the back of the shop. Past the display area, he opened a door and led her into a dark workroom. Come on, he said, crooking his finger. In the back, against the wall, was a canoe? He stepped to the loading dock and hit a button, and a grayish fluorescent light flickered on. He looked up at the blinking panels. "Irony of ironies," he said. Now she could see. A canoe, yes, but not just any canoe. It was beautiful, long and sleek and glossy, made of a light wood, but with a darker wood inlaid into a geometric design on the front. "Wow," she said. "It was just delivered this morning," he said. "You're the first to see it." At this, she looked away from him. She squatted, and when she ran her fingertips over the seams around the inlaid area, there wasn't the slightest alteration in how the wood felt. "Where do you go canoeing?" she said. "I tend to like rivers," he said. She couldn't tell if this was snide or not. She said, "You know, I should actually get going, but thanks for the look. It's beautiful." He said, "Sacramento River, Feather River, or if I have more time, I go up to Oregon." He watched her in an intent, focused way, and she wanted to say, "Okay, you win. I'm not woman enough for you, buddy." Instead, she said, "Does Mary like canoeing?" He smiled a different smile now, a pained smile she couldn't quite read. "Mary does," he said. "Mary likes canoeing." Back in the car, she sat still for a moment, watching as a homeless man passed by, pushing a shopping cart piled high with bloated bags. Half a mile away was the new Emeryville, with its terrifying IKEA, its nightmare version of a suburban shopping mall. Here, in front of Mark's shop, the last 30 years might never have happened. Seeing Mark always sparked something in Sarah Beth. Lust, but also loneliness, too. She turned her phone back on and called Liz, getting the voicemail at home and then trying her cell. "I was going to call you in maybe 20 minutes, Liz said by way of answering. "Beat you to it. I'm in line at the grocery store. Can I call you when I get home?" "Sure," Sarah Beth chirped. But when she'd stowed her phone, she lowered her forehead and rested it for a moment on the steering wheel. She started the car and headed home, taking Adeline for no other reason than to pass the Berkeley Bowl, the infamous Berkeley Bowl where she'd met Billy. She'd spotted him at the Heirloom Tomatoes, this tall man with small gold glasses and thick gray blonde hair. And she noticed even before they spoke, before that opening remark of his about the tomato that looked like George Bush, that he wore a wedding ring. She laughed at the tomato. It did have these flap-like things on the sides, like ears. And he mentioned a book his kids had that contained photographs of fruits and vegetables that seemed to have faces. And then there he was at the baked goods. And then in line at the cashier. It was a hot September day, and there was a fresh juice stand. And they bought smoothies and sat on the curb in front of her car and talked for 45 minutes while her peach sorbet melted and her free-range chicken got busy welcoming colonies of bacteria. And he was so interested in her, and he thought her lampshade sounded so cool. They met for coffee a few days later, and for lunch a week after that, and then for sex every Monday noon and Wednesday evening for the next 13 and a half months. And then they didn't. Now they didn't. It was coming, the anniversary of their breakup. She longed to be someone who could face such a thing with equanimity, who would not joke to her friends, as she'd been doing relentlessly, that when the day came, she would mark it somehow, by lighting a candle, calling him, slitting her wrists. Enough, she thought. Enough. She was driving. The sky was the intense blue of early autumn, and there were pumpkins on porches. Pumpkins already. Halloween was around the corner, and all at once, the entire holiday season loomed up on the bare calendar in her mind like a group of massive fortresses coming into view on an otherwise empty horizon. It came back then, the girl and the woman, walking in the mist. They were walking toward an empty horizon, a horizon that was all mist, She saw them clearly, the girl and the woman walking, and the girl looking up, but not speaking, never speaking. So a month has gone by, and in Liz's family, things are tense because her daughter Lauren is going through something that Liz doesn't understand yet but is concerned about. And on Sarah Beth's end, she has found out that Mark Murphy, the lampshade guy, and his wife are adopting a baby. And this is now Liz's point of view. She had the dark look around the eyes that Liz didn't like, the faintly hollowed cheeks. And she spoke a little too quickly, as she often did in times of difficulty. Trying to outrun herself was how Liz thought of it. I wonder how they'll manage, she kept saying. I wonder if maybe they're too old. They were at their usual Thai place south of Market, sitting at their usual table. The phone call that had brought this dinner into being had readied Liz for a Sarah Beth in bad shape, but not this bad, or not this apparently bad. She looked a little as she had in the weeks after her breakup with Billy. She was very sensitive to loss, as how could she not be? Though what she was losing if Mark adopted a baby, Liz couldn't quite see. Maybe just an idea, a wish. If you'd been through what she'd been through, that could be a lot. Do you think they're too old? Sarah Beth said. I mean, just from an energy standpoint? The answer, of course, was no. But what effect would that have? Put another way, would Sarah Beth be better off hearing how hard it would be? Or how wonderful? This dilemma was as familiar to Liz as the restaurant, the food, the melancholy look on Sarah Beth's face. Liz felt it was important to be truthful, but she also felt there was generally more than one truth, and the choice of which to deliver could help or hinder. What an adventure, she said, skirting the question altogether. Imagine, you go on a trip and return home with someone you're going to know for the rest of your life. The waitress arrived with their soup, and they leaned away from each other while she filled their bowls, the tangy, orangey milk of the broth, and the little curled bits of chicken. Tom Kagai, Sarah Beth said. This should help. Liz raised her wine glass. Years ago, they'd been in the habit of going to a different restaurant every time they met, the latest hot spot or some out-of-the-way gem Sarah Beth had discovered. But in the last few years, they'd settled here, and it was more honest somehow. Their dinners weren't about going out. They were about getting together. And as if to prove it, they ordered the same food every time. Hey, how's Lauren? Sarah Beth said after they'd both had their first taste of soup. I never heard how she liked Howard's End. Liz thought of Lauren's tear-stained face last Friday when she got her paper back, the way she'd allowed Liz to hold her, the way she'd allowed herself to be held. The next day, it had been as if none of it had ever happened. She didn't, she said. She had a hard time with the paper. Oh, I'm sorry, Sarah Beth said. I should have suggested something else. I feel bad. Don't be silly. She has to have these experiences, Liz said. You really think that? Liz remembered resisting Brody saying about the same thing. It's good practice for life. What did she think? Did she wish the kids had no challenges, no disappointments? What a pointless wish that would be, like wishing winter wouldn't come or illness or death. But in a way, she did wish it, because she hated the suffering. Never mind, she said. Let's talk about you. How's Anna Karenina? Sarah Beth smiled and leaned forward. Last Thursday, Esther comes up to me afterward and says, Dear Sarah Beth, this is the highlight of my week. And she hands me three incredibly old Hershey's Kisses, like with the little white tags practically gray. That's so sweet, Liz said. Isn't it? I always feel like she's handing me a tiny piece of her life. Maybe she is, Liz said. So someone will have it when she's gone. Oh, that's sad, Sarah Beth said, setting her spoon down and sinking back into her chair. And beautiful. You always say things that are so true. Please. You do. Billy noticed it. Did I ever tell you that? Sarah Beth kept her eyes on Liz for a moment, then colored and looked away. Liz thought of her one and only encounter with Billy. She had always feared, especially as they grew older, that Sarah Beth would find her way to a married man. But she'd never imagined someone as dangerous as Billy, as adept at hiding his treachery behind a veil of compassion and intelligence. She'd also never imagined how distressing it would be for her, nor how reluctant she'd be to meet him. Sarah Beth had begged for months. And finally, when Liz could make excuses no longer, she drove to Berkeley and had the most awkward and stilted lunch with the two of them. Sarah Beth trying so hard to be at ease, Billy as full of himself as she'd expected, and the idea of his family hovering everywhere. Leaving afterward, she had shaken his hand and said, "It was so nice meeting you," when what she was thinking was, "You monster." "I'm sorry," Sarah Beth said now. "For?" "Bringing it up. Actually, making you do it in the first place." Liz shook her head. Looking at Sarah Beth's tiny white face, her unruly hair, the curve of her narrow shoulders, she had a renewed awareness of how much Billy had meant to Sarah Beth, saw how much Sarah Beth was still in anguish. In a few minutes, the waitress arrived with their red curry beef, and they waited while she cleared away the soup. "I've been thinking," Sarah Beth said once she was gone. "Maybe I should invite her to tea. Esther, I mean. Like I could take her to a place with scones and real china, and we'd sit there and talk about life. But I'm not so sure I should. It's like, do I want to change the relationship?" "That's a good question," Liz said. "It's like my mother and Mrs. Noodleman." "Your mother and Mrs. Noodleman what?" Sarah Beth said. "When she got sick, my mother took her lunch every day. You didn't know that?" "I don't think so," Sarah Beth said. And then, "God, Mrs. Noodleman, I haven't thought of her in years." She had lived across the street from Liz's family, right next to Sarah Beth's, an old lady in a small Spanish-style house, fronted by the most beautiful garden. Long before Mrs. Noodleman fell ill, Liz's mother had been friendly with her, asking her for advice on growing tulips in California, bringing home jars of her kumquat preserves. Then the roles changed. "What did she have?" Sarah Beth said. "Cancer." "Did we know that?" "I don't think so," Liz said. "Or if we did, we didn't know what it meant." She pinched up some rice in her chopsticks and dabbed it in the sauce. It was strange. In childhood, the idea of cancer had been so terrible, it had been almost without meaning. And that somehow made it not terrible, made it nearly nothing. She thought of how knowledge accumulated in layers rather than linearly, how you learn the same things over and over, but differently each time, more deeply. This made her think of rain, sprinkling lightly, dampening the earth, and then sprinkling again and pouring down, and the earth taking it in and getting wet with it, drenched with it. And then, over time, gradually drying out again, as in old age, the mind sometimes cleared itself, and memories and knowledge were lost. "Do you ever dream about Cowper Street?" she asked Sarah Beth. "Not that I remember. Do you?" "I dream about our backyard, the orange trees. I don't exactly dream about them, but I kind of dream their smell." "That smell," Sarah Beth said. After dinner, they stood together outside the restaurant, clutching their coats close. They were almost directly under the freeway, and the sound of cars on wet road was everywhere. "So, a week from tomorrow," Liz said, "are you sure you don't mind bringing your same salad?" "Of course I don't mind," Sarah Beth said. "Anyway, the kids love it." "That's not a good reason. Would you rather bring something different?" "Liz," Sarah Beth said, "are you sure you don't mind making your same turkey?" "Okay, you got me." They hugged and parted, and Liz started the long walk to the garage where she always parked. It unnerved her a little, being alone in the city at night, and she kept a brisk pace, her purse tight at her side. In the van, she felt better. As she made her way to the garage exit, she thought for some reason of those orange trees on Cowper Street with their hard, shiny leaves. There'd been lemon trees, too, that produced lemons with incredibly thick skins. You'd cut one open, and there'd be half an inch of white pith surrounding the tart fruit. Her mother had made lemonade with them. Liz remembered the summer when she and Sarah Beth were 13, how day after day they sat under the big tree in the backyard and read aloud the advice column from 17 magazine, all the while sipping from tall glasses of homemade lemonade. If John had a friend over, they'd read in loud voices, trying to attract the older boy's attention. If Steve had a friend over, Liz would tell them not to come out back, and Steve would pout and tell their mother. But in the end, Liz and Sarah Beth would be left alone, the yard theirs. How long ago that was, when you could be at once so dramatic and so innocent. She paid the garage attendant, and soon she was on the freeway, doing 60, heading home. She switched to 280, drove past the neon of the Saramonte Center, along the rim of the vast, light-dotted bowl that was South San Francisco. The airport became visible, then the wide, irradiated mouth of the valley. And then the freeway twisted to the west, and soon there was little to see from the road, but the darker dark of the hills, the lighter dark of the sky. No one knew where she was right now. Not precisely, not with complete certainty. She approached the turnoff for 92, the road to Half Moon Bay, and she imagined a piece of herself splitting off, taking the turn in an alternate van, the two of them heading up the mountain, other Liz and other van, the twists and turns of the narrow road. She followed them to the top, then stopped at the first point on the downward stretch where the ocean became visible. From there, she leaped to the distant beach, soaring downward with her arms spread. And she remembered a moment in college, in a class on 20th century poetry that Sarah Beth, from across the bay, had urged her to take because the professor was a famous poet herself, visiting just for the quarter. There was a long poem that the professor had read aloud, and at the end, it was something or other about birds going downward toward darkness on extended wings. The words themselves, dark and majestic, as they filled the Stanford classroom. "They're on extended wings," the professor said when she was finished reading. "But they do go down." All these years later, Liz remembered the moment vividly. The professor, with her little voice, speaking of the biggest things there were. The chill she felt as she listened. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Carl Bernstein, Richard Russo, Mary Carwile, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 10th, 2007.